an exoplanet milestone, and talking about space junk. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. In the search for planets outside our solar system, NASA is celebrating a big milestone. The agency, so far, has confirmed more than 6,000 potential exoplanets orbiting stars other than our sun. Planetary scientists and hosts of the podcast Walk About the Galaxy, Josh Caldwell and Addie Dove, join us to delve into this milestone and lay out what's ahead in identifying planets outside our solar system. Then, over the coming weeks, we'll be tackling space junk on this show. To kick off our periodic conversations on orbital debris, we'll talk with a researcher about talking about space junk. Communication scholar and professor Patrice Cole joins us to talk about space junk risks and how the public understands the issue. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? It's no secret we're big fans of exoplanets on this show. From the missions aimed at finding planets outside of our solar system to the scientists leading the charge in identifying them, we've had plenty to talk about over the years. And here's just one more thing. Earlier this month, NASA announced a big milestone in exoplanet research. The agency says its tally of exoplanets has passed 6,000. It's a big leap from the initial discovery of an exoplanet 30 years ago, and scientists say it's just the beginning. Here to reflect on that milestone and chart the course for the next few years of exoplanet discovery is Josh Caldwell and Addie Dove. They are planetary scientists at the University of Central Florida and hosts of the podcast Walk About the Galaxy. Josh, Addie, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
Thanks for having us.
Happy to be here.
Today we're talking on a pretty incredible milestone. NASA has announced that the number of exoplanets that it tracks has topped 6,000, which is pretty incredible thinking that the first exoplanet was confirmed just a few decades ago. Josh, tell us a bit about the idea of exoplanets and how they were discovered.
Well, the idea of them goes way back. As long as we've known what planets are and that they orbit stars and that we've known that the lights in the sky are other stars, we have assumed that planets are orbiting them, but it took a long time before we were actually able to confirm that. I mean, I'm a Trekkie, so there were planets assumed to be all over the galaxy in Star Trek, but it wasn't until 1998 we were able to actually confirm the existence of exoplanets. And those first exoplanets that were discovered get a big asterisk next to them because they're orbiting a pulsar, which is the remnant of a massive star. A star much more massive than the sun. Our sun will not become a pulsar. It was discovered by measuring timing shifts in the pulsar. These are very, very precise astrophysical clocks, if you will, because they're spinning quickly and their spin period can be measured very precisely. So that was like, okay, they're out there, but I put the big asterisk because they're not really like the kinds of planets that we visited in Star Trek.
Addie, since then, how have astronomers been able to find exoplanets? They're not all using pulsars, right?
No, yeah, and actually very few are using pulsars these days, right? First of all, we don't expect a lot of planets around sort of those types of systems, but then also just the techniques we've used to discover them have expanded. So a lot of them rely on what's called transit techniques. So this is like you stare at a star and you look at the brightness of the star and it'll dip. If a planet goes in front of it, it dips a little bit. You can see a little bit of that brightness is blocked out. And actually you get a change when the planet goes behind the star too due to reflected starlight. And then there's another cool technique called the radial velocity technique, which is also staring at the star. So the interesting thing about most of these techniques, right, is that we're actually looking at the star to do the main parts of the detection. And with the radial velocity technique, basically like this, we're observing the star and its spectrum, so the light coming off of it. And as a planet goes around it, it makes the star wobble a little bit, and that changes its velocity slightly, and that shifts where the lines are, the spectral lines that we observe. So you can see that like if there's more of a wobble, there's a different planet. And so we can use those techniques. And one of the interesting things I think, so this is 6,000 sort of confirmed planets is the recent thing, but there are something like another 6,000 or 8,000 or something like that of planet candidates out there as well. So all these searches, like Kepler is the big mission that's been doing a lot of detections. When the first time they're detected, especially during like the transit or the radial velocity technique, they're called candidates because we say, well, there's a signal here, but we need another additional observation to confirm that it's actually there. And so sometimes the follow-ups are with the other techniques. Sometimes they're with direct imaging, although that's still really, really hard.
Yeah, I just want to mention my favorite way, which is not the most efficient way, which is gravitational microlensing. And so it requires some serendipity because massive objects like stars act like lenses for light just through their gravity. So not a direct lensing like we think about with our glasses or light passing through water or something like that, but being bent because the mass of the star bends space-time, and a planet around a star is like a little flaw in the lens, and it results in a very characterizable particular glitch in the light that you see passing through that gravitational lens. So we've discovered some planets in some very clever, interesting ways.
What current observatories are able to see that gravitational lensing?
Gravitational lensing doesn't require a particularly special observatory. As I said, it requires serendipity because you need to be monitoring the light from some distant object over some long period of time and see that the light of that object changes because a lens passed in front of us. And in this case, the lens would be some other star nearby moving in front of it. And if that star has a planet, then you see a funny little bump and a wiggle in that light curve.
Addy, you mentioned that there are thousands of candidates that there needs to be follow-ups on. More than 6,000 confirmed, thousands more that are potentially candidates. What do you credit all of these discoveries to? Is it the fact that there are just more telescopes that are searching for these things?
Yes. So we've had ideas about how we might be able to do it for a long time, but it takes pretty precise engineering, really good techniques of data analysis. So I said, like, when it was for the transit technique, when a planet goes in front of a star, the dip in light is something like 99.9% of the light of the star is still there, right? So it's higher than that sometimes. So it's these little tiny, tiny dips. So we have to be able to be looking at a really, really bright star and say, oh, the light's changed a teeny, tiny bit. So we need really great telescopes. We need really good processing techniques. We need to know and understand sort of what the period is, like how long it would take to make those things. And also for a lot of these, you need several observations. So if you think about the Earth, it goes around the sun in 1 year. Jupiter goes around in about 5 years. So you need to see sort of repeated changes. You have to have at least that period, right, in order to see it. And so things that are further out take even longer. A lot of the planets we discovered early on are hot Jupiters. So they're big things that are close to the star because they make a significant difference in our observations and they do it quickly. So in a few years of observations, you can say, oh yeah, we've seen this multiple times. So that's why we can do it. Also, like we mentioned, the Kepler Space Telescope tests. There's a bunch of space telescopes that have been deployed to do this. And there's also a bunch of ground-based surveys that just say, okay, we're going to stare at this part of the sky and we're going to look for new things or confirm the things we've already seen.
Kepler was really a breakthrough because it was the first observatory that could monitor thousands of stars simultaneously and measure these light curves. It's a big technological breakthrough. I just want to mention Jupiter's 5 times further away, but its year is 12 years long, not 5 years long, which means that if you want to see a planet like Jupiter from a transiting technique, you have to wait really 24 years just to have a confirmation the second time around of that thing passing in front of the star. You see it once, well, okay, something happened to that star, which is one reason why so many of those 6,000 planets and the other thousands that Addy mentioned are very, very different than the planets that we're familiar with in our own solar system.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? Here on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Josh Caldwell and Addy Dove. They're both UCF planetary scientists and co-hosts of the podcast Walk About the Galaxy. We're talking about exoplanets, which are planets outside of our solar system that orbit other stars. NASA has announced that we've reached over 6,000 confirmed candidates of these. You both brought up the fact that there is this time, right? We have to wait all this time to see these things pass in front of their stars, you know, multiple times to get data. The exoplanets that we found, or do we think that they are closer to their star and we'll start discovering more and more farther out as time goes on?
Yeah, a lot of the early systems we detected, like I said, have these really bright, really big things close in. That were close in. So these are like Jupiter sized things that are at the orbit of Mercury or closer to their star, right? So they're like crazy close and they make this giant wobble or they cause a bigger transit dip. But as we get these repeated measurements, we are able to see more and more systems. And we can also see more planetary systems that have multiple planets in them.
We had our idea about what a planetary system looks like from our own solar system. And then we go out there, and because observations sort of favor finding these hot Jupiters that Addy was describing, of course, we didn't think there would be any hot Jupiters, but lo and behold, there's a bunch of them. The sort of family tree or zoology of exoplanets is very different than what we imagined before we had started discovering them based on our own solar system. So there are all sorts of interesting worlds that don't really fit with Jupiter and Saturn or with Earth or with Uranus and Neptune. There's ocean worlds and these hot Jupiters and lava worlds, and certainly hopeful that we'll start to see some systems like our own, but we really haven't yet.
Have we been able to get a look at what these planets may look like? We're mentioning this transiting method, which seems to be the most popular method to determine these candidates here, but have we been able to see what these planets actually look like? They're far away, right?
They're very far away. Yeah, they're around other stars, right? So they're very, very far away. We only have direct imaging of a few, maybe like 100 of these planets. We have been getting more different types of image. So that's like sort of direct visible light imaging, right? There's other ways we have sort of more direct observations. And one of those is like, especially now with James Webb, JWST, we're able to get spectra that are of the atmospheres around planets, which is really cool and gives us a better way to understand that they have atmospheres and what the constituents are in the atmospheres. And so that's a really cool way to sort of more directly get at what the planet is than just having sort of the indirect technique looking at the star.
The main thing that we've got for most of them is something about their size, and then sometimes something about their mass. And from that, you can get something about their density. And then you can maybe say, okay, well, it's this close to a star, so it's this hot, it has this kind of density, but it is very hard to see them because there's this bright shining star nearby.
And so you're looking for stars that are in what scientists call the habitable zone, right? That could have liquid water or be like our planet, right?
That's one of the sort of the holy grails for part of this research, is to find planets that might be habitable. So exoplanets. And so the habitable zone is typically defined as where the temperatures could support liquid water on the surface. And we have seen planets in habitable zones. They don't look like Earth in terms of their size and their density. And they're typically orbiting cooler stars, so they're much closer to the star. Sometimes this gives you a planet that is tidally locked, just like the moon is with the Earth. We always see the same side of the moon. Many of these planets will always have the same face facing the star. So one side of the planet is in perpetual daylight and the other side is in perpetual nighttime. And then you could imagine that ribbon, the terminator between day and night, is perpetually lovely. Not too hot, not too cold.
Mm-hmm. The Goldilocks part of the planet, right? Yeah.
Exactly.
We hit the 6,000 mark in the 1990s. It was just a handful. By the 2020s, we're in the 6,000 mark. When do we hit 10,000?
Pretty soon, right?
2028.
Okay. I'll hold you to it. I'll hold you to it.
I mean, so we have 6,000, right? And there's another just as many that are sort of candidates. So it's really just sort of doing this check and confirmation. And by 2028, we have another few years of observations. There's all of these telescopes doing it. So I think 28 is a reasonable number.
We'll have you on the show before then, but we'll definitely have to schedule something for 2028. So
if we get to 10,000 before 2028, then you can have it back on Rub My Face.
Sounds good. We've been speaking with Josh Caldwell and Addie Dove. They're both UCF planetary scientists and co-hosts of the podcast Walk About the Galaxy. Get it wherever you get this podcast. Josh, Addie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us. Always a pleasure.
Still to come, space junk and how to talk about it.
Do people perceive the issue as being mostly confined to space? Or do they realize that this could really have a significant impact on the way that we lead our day-to-day lives?
Understanding the risks and public perceptions of orbital debris. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. A sample of Martian rock collected by NASA's Perseverance rover could preserve evidence of ancient microbial life. Next week on Are We There Yet? We'll speak with NASA's head of science, Nikki Fox, about this finding and how NASA might determine whether or not this truly is evidence of life on another planet. But for now, we're talking about space junk. Technically, it's called orbital debris, and over the course of the next few weeks, we're going to explore this growing issue. But first, before we talk about space debris, we need to talk about talking about space debris. Patrice Cole is an assistant professor at SUNY College of Environmental Sciences and Forestry. Her research focuses on communication and how it shapes public understanding of complex science and environmental issues. She's been looking at orbital debris, or space junk, and how the public understands the issues and risks. And a note, as a graduate student, I worked with Patrice on research related to space debris. She joins us now to talk about her latest research on the issue. Patrice, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Thank you for inviting me.
We're going to talk a bit about your research, but first let's broadly talk about space junk. What is it?
So generally speaking, when people are referring to space junk, they're referring to human-made objects, you know, that are discarded, no longer work, that are in orbit around Earth, you know, orbital debris or space junk. But generally when people are talking about space junk, that's what they're referring to.
Now, Patrice, your specialty is in communication and how we talk about things. What is your interest in space junk and what is your research focused on?
I think there's a general consensus within the space community that's concerned about space junk. And often one of the reasons that people point to as to why we're not seeing space agencies and, governments and commercial space actors take the difficult steps that need to be taken to address the issue is that there's just not a lot of public pressure. You know, we're making a lot of assumptions about what people know or how familiar they are with the issue or, if they're introduced to the issue, what concerns they have. Do people perceive the issue as being mostly confined to space? Or do they realize that this could really have a significant impact on the way that we lead our day-to-day lives if we were to, have to live without space, so to speak, and no longer have the satellite services that we rely on increasingly from year to year.
What risks does space debris pose for us down here on Earth?
Yeah, so probably the biggest risk is the risk posed by the debris that's in orbit. As more and more debris accumulates in orbit, the higher and higher risk you have of, debris collisions, both with active satellites and spacecraft, and also between two pieces of orbital debris. And that's really problematic because you might think when, these pieces of debris break up that they're smaller and they're less dangerous, but the opposite is actually true because then you basically have a big cloud of shrapnel. This stuff is moving so fast that something the size of a marble can have the impact of a hand grenade. So, and the debris that is sent up into space can stay in orbit anywhere from a few years to decades to centuries to thousands of years. And at its extreme, you could end up with a cascade of collisions and where you have so much debris in some of our orbits that those orbits are no longer safe to use and could even trap us on Earth, potentially.
Which is a terrifying outlook to think. We're stuck here, yeah.
But that's not the only risk that there is. There's also risks due to orbital debris falling back to Earth, particularly when you have the uncontrolled re-entry of large objects like, rocket bodies. And most of the time when it comes to falling debris, most of it's going to burn up in the atmosphere before it reaches Earth. And the stuff that does reach Earth is mostly going to fall into the ocean or land in, in uninhabited areas, but not all of it. And when we have large rocket bodies, those typically do not burn up entirely in the atmosphere. And when they return in what's referred to as an uncontrolled reentry, that definitely poses a risk to, people on Earth. And also there's a growing concern about the risk that these large pieces of debris pose to commercial aircraft. It's a smaller risk in comparison to the risk that orbital debris, pose to satellites.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? Here on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Patrice Cole, an assistant professor at SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry, about space debris and her research on how the public feels about space junk. Patrice, let's talk about some of that research. And we should note that when I was a graduate student at the University of Central Florida, you and I worked on a paper together together on space debris. What have you learned? You've done a lot of communication research about what people know and how people perceive this as a risk. What are people on Earth saying about it?
Yeah. So, well, we were interested since we anticipated that this would be an issue that's, you know, not familiar to most people. We started out our research with in-depth interviews and surveys to find out, you know, what people think orbital debris or space junk is and, you know, where they think it is, right? Because that all can have an influence on, you know, what they think about the risks of orbital debris or space junk. So when I was doing in-depth interviews with people, asking them, when you hear the term orbital debris, what do you think of? For the most part, people interpreted it as being made up of man-made objects. And for the most part, people thought of it as something that was mostly in near-Earth space. But there were some people who I interviewed who thought it referred to, you know, dust or rocks. And that's not necessarily wrong. Sometimes you do see some definitions that include micrometeorites in their definition of orbital debris. But for the most part, and if you look at the definition offered in, you know, a report that NASA put out on sustainability last year, we're usually talking about man-made objects, which again is how NASA defines it in their 2024 sustainability planning report. And then when it comes to where people think debris is, some people thought it was, you know, floating off in distant space or orbiting the solar system or the moon. We asked people, you know, whether they thought it was mostly human-made or mostly, you know, natural. And we found that depending on what term we used when we asked them those questions, their answer was a little bit different. So they were more likely to say that they thought it was made out of human-made objects if we asked them about space junk, whereas with orbital debris, a little under a smaller percentage of people thought it was human-made and a larger percentage of people thought it was natural. So if we want to clearly communicate to people that what we're concerned about here is the man-made debris that we're leaving up there or junk, we're likely going to be better at communicating that to audiences if we're using the phrase space junk rather than orbital debris. We also found, interestingly, while a majority of Americans in our survey, which was nationally representative, did think of it as being in near-Earth space, you still had a substantial minority who thought it was in distant space. Mm-hmm. And so we had about 33% of our respondents thought it was in faraway space, which has important implications for how we understand the risks of space junk.
Yes, it's not. It's much closer to home, right? Your research also looked at U.S. adults and how much they were concerned about the consequences of space junk. What did you find there?
One of the things we found in our in-depth interviews and that we asked people about when we did our surveys. You know, one of the things we heard from people in the in-depth interviews is that people didn't really see it as being personally salient. They would say things like, it doesn't really impact me at all in my daily life. I'm not rocketing into orbit, so I'm not too concerned about orbital debris.
That's fair, right?
So we definitely we're seeing like the perception that this was a problem confined to space. So we asked people on the survey how concerned they were about the consequences of space junk, you know, for space exploration, for people on Earth, for you personally. And, you know, we had about 35% who were on the survey who said they were extremely or very concerned about the consequences of space junk for space exploration. But for themselves, it was just 19%. And then for people on Earth, 26% who were extremely or very concerned about the consequences of space junk. So, I mean, which isn't too surprising. And then what we did later later on in the survey to kind of tease out, you know, some of the factors that explain people's concern about the consequences of space junk for themselves, people on Earth, or space exploration. We also asked them some questions about their concerns about the risks of falling space junk. We also asked them about their concerns about the consequences of orbiting space junk. And then we also asked them a series of questions about, you know, what they perceived the effects of space junk could be on six different satellite reliant services. And we found that when it came to increasing, you know, concern about the consequences of space junk for people on Earth and yourself, we found that, you know, perceived effects of orbital debris on satellite services was important for all three levels of concern. But we also found that concerns about falling debris were important for concern about the consequences of space junk for oneself and people on Earth. But not too surprisingly, it wasn't associated with increased concern for space exploration. When you have stories like you do about, you know, a piece of space junk, you know, crashing into a house in Naples, Florida, you know, flights being grounded or rerouted, you know, because, you know, Starship or some other spacecraft has exploded. I think those kinds of stories may be what starts to move the needle in terms of, you know, grabbing people's attention and generating public concern about the issue and finally putting public pressure on politicians to fill in gaps in policy.
What can be done to mitigate the risks of space debris?
You know, one area where we could develop stronger policy and regulations is in ensuring that when companies launch things into orbit, that they have technologies on those rocket bodies to ensure that they can return in a controlled way. And then there are things like ensuring that people have a plan, you know, satellite operators for when their satellites or other spacecraft are no longer usable. And there is some movement to try and get people to ensure, for example, that those objects are brought down like a 5-year time frame. And then there's efforts to develop technologies to basically, you know, create, I guess you could say, kind of like space junk dump trucks.
Space junk dump trucks. I love it.
I don't think it would quite work like that, but yeah. It's a metaphor.
We've been speaking with Patrice Cole, an assistant professor at SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry, about her research in space debris and how we talk about it. Patrice, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Subscribe on the Central Florida Public Media app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or really wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay connected to this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. We're on Instagram and Facebook at AWTY Space. And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out to us. Our email is arewetthereyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.